I'm Morris Wee. I'm a parish pastor in Northfield, Minnesota. And this week I'm leading the Bible studies. There's a series of five on the Joseph story from Genesis 37 to 50. We'll be reading through most of that as part of our study and then talking about those sections together. Yesterday, the group looked at Genesis 37, which is the part of the story in which Joseph tells his dreams to his brothers about how they'll bow down to him. They're offended. They get angry with Joseph, partly because his father favors him. He has this coat of long sleeves, which means he doesn't have to do the labor that they have to do. And they decide to kill him. But Judah and Reuben talk them out of killing him. And instead, they sell him into slavery in Egypt. And that chapter ends with Reuben discovering that he's been taken from the pit and sold and ripping his garments. Then they bring the coat of long sleeves to the father, having dipped it in blood. He rips his garments and he says, surely Joseph has been torn to pieces. There's this tearing that takes place at the end, and that's why my title was The Tearing, or A Family is Torn. However, I forgot to mention yesterday the last verse of chapter 37, which after the father has said, I'm going to go down to Sheol to my son mourning. I'm going to mourn for the rest of my life. And we're at the kind of depths of this experience, the repercussions of what these brothers have done and their treachery. We have one final verse. Meanwhile, the Midianites had sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard. And that little verse tacked on the end, for the hearer or the reader of this text, certainly suddenly introduces hope. There's more to the story of Joseph. It's not over. He's not dead and gone as his father thinks he is. There's something more that's going to happen to him. We wouldn't have had this detail about who he got sold to if there wasn't going to be more to come. And so there's that little tag of hope at the end of that chapter. And then the Bible moves on to chapter 38. I want to say a couple of introductory things that I failed to say, so I'm going to stop now since there's an interlude here. Chapter 38 interjects itself. Ask if anybody has trouble hearing and would like some device, which we have in the tape ministry, help you hear better, or on the other hand, raise your hand if you can't hear me and I'll talk louder. There's that. An invitation to come to the other days this week when we'll follow through this story. I know that's not always possible. People come and go and you have other plans. I'll try to have something coherent each day so that you don't feel like it's worthless if you're not here for all 5 days. And finally, interrupt me at any time to make comments or to ask questions. Enter this time of reading Scripture, assuming that it's God's Word for us, and that there's something, as we heard today, there's some surprise, possibly, in this for us. Some new thing, even though this is a familiar story. It's a living word, and there may be some new piece of it that comes to us today. Thank you so much for those matins this morning. It was wonderful. Chapter 38 is the story of Judah and Tamar. And it seems, as you read the story of Joseph, to be a complete non sequitur. You know, what's it doing here? Just stuck in here in the middle. But I do think it's in the right place and it's there for some good purposes with regard to the story of Joseph. I'll briefly summarize what happens there. If you're around next week, we'll be looking at this story in detail along with three other stories of women, so that I can't be accused of only talking about the men in Scripture, though it's all the brothers pretty much in this one. But In short, Judah's son marries Tamar and dies. It's the duty of his second son then to marry Tamar. He refuses to, he spills his seed, as it's put, so that she can't have children with him, and then God doesn't like that and he dies. And Judah doesn't want his third son to marry this woman. He's afraid she's a hex. And so he doesn't send his third son to marry her when he's of the appropriate age. This is against the laws of levirate marriage that he should have abided by. And it leaves her without support, because she's now a woman who's been married, this is the best form of support that she could find in that setting, was to have the brother marry her. So Judah fails her and is irresponsible. She tricks him by posing as a cult prostitute, and he sleeps with her. She becomes pregnant. She finds ways of indicating that he's been the father. I mean, she's done this in disguise. And he says, "I was wrong. I mistreated you." Takes her back into the family. And this is significant because she is part of the lineage of Jesus, and that's why the story appears here. What this does here is develop something of the character of Judah. Judah is one of the two brothers who said, "Let's not spill Joseph's blood, let's not kill him, let's just put him in this pit and then sell him for a little profit." And Judah figures significantly later in this story as well. So this chapter develops his character, and what we see is a person who at the outset, at any rate, is not very responsible, who recognizes he's done wrong at the end. Now we get chapter 39 with Joseph down in Egypt, and let's hear the readers who volunteered read that, starting from the first verse.
"Now Joseph was taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard, the Egyptian, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had brought him down there. The Lord was with Joseph, and he became a successful man, and he was in the house of his master the Egyptian, and his master saw that the Lord was with him, and that the Lord caused all that he did to prosper in his hands. So Joseph found favor in his sight and attended him, and he made him overseer of his house, and put him in charge of all that he had. From the time that he made him overseer in his house and over all that he had, the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. The blessing of the Lord was upon all that he had in house and field. So he left all that he had in Joseph's charge, and having him, he had no concern for anything but the food which he ate. Now Joseph was handsome and good-looking. And after a time, his master's wife cast her eyes upon Joseph and said, 'Lie with me.' But he refused and said to his master's wife,
'Lo, having me, my master has no concern about anything in the house, and he has put everything that he has in my hand. He is not greater in this house than I am, nor has he kept back anything from me except yourself, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?'
And although she spoke to Joseph day after day, he would not listen to her, to lie with her or to be with her. But one day, when he went into the house to do his work, and none of the men of the house was there in the house, she caught him by his garment, saying, 'Lie with me.' But he left his garment in her hand and fled and got out of the house. And when she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and had fled out of the house, she called to the men of her household and said to them, 'See, he has brought among us a Hebrew to insult us. He came in to me to lie with me, and I cried out with a loud voice. And when he heard that, I lifted up my voice and cried. He left his garment with me and fled and got out of the house.' Then she laid up his garment by her until his master came home. And she told him the same story, saying, 'The Hebrew servant whom you have brought among us came in to me to insult me. But as soon as I lifted up my voice and cried, he left his garment with me and fled out of the house.' When his master heard the words which his wife spoke to him, 'This is the way your servant treated me,' his anger was kindled. And Joseph's master took him and put him into the prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in prison. But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him steadfast love and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's care all the prisoners who were in the prison. And whatever was done there, he was the doer of it. The keeper of the prison paid no heed to anything that was in Joseph's care, because the Lord was with him. And whatever he did, the Lord made it prosper.
Thank you. When you hear this read in a piece, I think you can't help but hear the themes that are central in this chapter, because they're repeated numerous times. The first thing that happens, the first theme that is addressed, is in verse 2. Verse 1 repeats almost exactly what the last verse of chapter 37, that Joseph was taken down into Egypt and sold to Potiphar, captain of the guard. So we know the story is taking up right where it left off, before this interlude about Judah and Tamar, and then the next words we hear are, "The Lord was with Joseph." And that is a phrase that we hear about four times in this chapter. It keeps coming back, and clearly it's one of the central ideas. Now, God was never mentioned in chapter 37. But at this point, God becomes a major character in this story. And while God was somewhere in chapter 37 too, was never mentioned. Suddenly here, the Lord was with him, the Lord was with Joseph, the Lord was with Joseph, repeated. And then there are corollaries to this. How do you know that the Lord was with Joseph? According to this text, how can you tell? He prospers. He prospers. And this is repeated. Pardon?
That sounds like the television ministry. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a very problematic assumption, but it's made repeatedly in here. The Lord was with Joseph, and he became a successful man. That's just linked together. Furthermore, his master saw the Lord was with him. The Lord caused all that he did to prosper in his hands. Same thing is repeated. And the furthermore thing that I was getting to was Joseph found favor in his sight. That's the second thing that happens. Everything prospers that he does. He finds favor in the sight of others. They notice that things are prospering. They like him because of it. And in this case, in each case, he's given authority over things. And I hadn't noticed until it was read this morning at the first hour, the emphasis on all that he had. Potiphar gives him authority over all that he had. Four times this thing is repeated, all that he had. He entrusts everything to Joseph, which is extraordinary. This is a slave come from another country. He's 17 years old. And but the Lord being with him leads to prosperity, favor in the eyes of others, and he's given authority over large amounts of things. That's the first episode in this chapter, and the last episode is almost identical. It takes place in the jail, and in between the other one.
And yeah. He says something about Potiphar's judgment, too. Because later Potiphar is jumping conclusions about Joseph, and that mm-hmm. also shows that his judgment isn't Joseph was a good man, but here he is putting all that he has into a 17-year-old's hands.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. He's quick to assume that this is going to work, and he's quick to respond to his wife's accusations. Yeah.
We don't know how quick it was, however, because it could have been, as he was given small responsibilities and fulfilled them well, that he would quickly raise, but that it was in steps.
Yeah, that's.
I mean, we can't assume that it was just automatic. It would take over.
Right.
But although he proved himself.
The timeline isn't made clear.
No.
The way it's narrated to us, it feels like this. You know, it feels as though he proved himself very quickly, at any rate.
Even in the prison, it wouldn't have been immediately because there's too much involved.
Sure. Yeah.
Someone suggested he was 17 years old. Well,
How did you determine he was 17 years old?
In chapter 37, it says he was 17 years old and at the time his brothers sold him into slavery. And so this portion begins when he's that age.
But it's conceivable, isn't it, that some time could have elapsed between, that he could be now a number of years older than that? Or we don't know that, I guess.
We don't know. It feels as though he got taken down to Egypt and sold to Potiphar in a short period of time. That was a journey of several days. But how soon he's put in charge of the household is another matter. How long the Ishmaelites, or was it the... Yeah, it's the Ishmaelites in this chapter anyway. How long they hung on to him before they sold him, holding out for more money, I don't know.
I'm sure Potiphar's wife wasn't interested in an old man.
We'll just drop that. All right.
It says in the next chapter, 41, that he's 30 years old when he goes into the service of the Pharaoh, so we know that he's not 30.
Right. He's in prison in the interval.
Yeah.
Yeah. And for quite some time, apparently. Yeah. Well, to look back to the things that happened because the Lord was with him, success, favor, then the God blesses. It's a new word. It's a word we associate with God's activity. God blesses, because for Joseph's sake, the household of Potiphar. And Potiphar is left with no concern for anything except the food he ate. This theme comes back again with the jailer and with Pharaoh. They entrust everything to Joseph, and they're sure that it's going to be fine. They no longer have to worry about it. So they think, and maybe this was bad judgment, but that's how he felt, and the jailer after him. Now, in between those two episodes, we have this scene with Potiphar's wife. And I think I'm just going to ask you to discuss that together. The things, my opinions on it, were called into question immediately in the first hour. And I realized I was wrong. I'd like you to take a look at Joseph's reaction to her. And making note of this raises issues of that are issues for us today about sexual harassment, about testimony, who gets believed.
That's my first reaction. Nothing changes. I mean, this is an awful long time ago. And we have the same thing happening today, and we're much more aware of sexual harassment today than it was. And yet we still have to remember this part happens, too. Mm-hmm. And the dilemma in finding out the truth.
Yeah.
Very difficult.
Yeah.
And nobody was in the house. She was really careful about that.
Right. Yeah. And you see how things... genuine feelings get distorted by jealousy, it's not misunderstanding here, it's just different value systems. how the passion involved in that setting can lead to abuse of power. In this case, the one person gets to speak twice, and the other person doesn't get to speak at all. And contrary to most examples, it's the woman who gets heard and the man who is not heard. But it's the woman who is in the position of power in this setting, and the man is not. At any rate, that's not all I want you to think about, but I'd like you to get in groups of three and talk about what effect or affects this episode of Joseph and Potiphar's wife has in the course of this story. You're reading about Joseph, you see about how he's favored with Potiphar, and suddenly we have this episode in here. What function does it serve, or how does it affect your sense of Joseph and of what's happening in the story? Because, I'll let you take 5 minutes and just see what you come up with, and then we'll come back together and talk some more. All right? Okay, I'm going to ask you to quit those conversations. Just cut them off. Even though you're in the midst of good things, and take them up again at coffee. You have to quit. Sorry. No more fun. All right, forgive me for making you get started like that, and as soon as you get going, I cut you off. But otherwise, you just have to take up the rest of those conversations somewhere else. But I want to hear a little bit about what your group discovered, about how this episode moves the story, or what effect it has. Any volunteers?
Yeah. Well, we had Carolyn made an interesting point in our group. I thought that we don't know Joseph's interior life in this story. He's passive. Things happen to him. Mm-hmm. And the story just tells about him, but it's more external stuff. You mm-hmm. know? And here in this chapter, we learned that he was handsome and good-looking, and mm-hmm. In addition to being blessed by God. But how he felt about this episode, we don't right. really know. But even though he's passive, the Lord is with him, and so he comes out shining in the end.
Mm-hmm.
But
we were talking about him as a passive character that, in a way, we don't know so well.
Mm-hmm.
But is he that passive when he rips away from her? She's grabbed him physically and tears himself out of her hands, even if it means leaving his clothes behind, mm-hmm. which was a wraparound, and says, "How can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?" Mm-hmm. Not against Potiphar so much. This is a sin against God, which to me reveals Joseph as showing his true morality here and his character, which is being honed and further honed in prison. But he certainly, I don't see him as that passive.
Well, one of the gals in our group was saying that he didn't seem very passive when he's saying, I mean, we didn't use the word passive, but that's sort of the opposite of what we were talking about. When he says very confidently, "Everything in this house is mine," he just sounds very confident. That sounds like an unusual thing for a slave to mm-hmm. say. "I'm in charge of everything."
Mm-hmm. It is a feature of a narrative like this, and most biblical narrative, that's somewhat less introspective than a 20th century novel. You know, we get the objective facts, and we are then must interpret that this was a fairly assertive statement and assertive action. It is true that Joseph is a slave in the house, and one could say, well, he's in a situation where somebody has crossed some boundaries here that are inappropriate, and maybe he should get himself out of there. But he doesn't have the option to get himself out of there. He has to go back every day into this house and work in the midst of this difficult transgression of boundaries, as we call it these days. What other kinds of things?
Potiphar's wife's seduction is kind of a foil against which the integrity of Joseph is shown up, just like the plotting of Joseph's brothers is also the foil against which Joseph's integrity is maintained.
Yeah.
But I think that the point is that even though you are a person of integrity, you sometimes are high and sometimes you are low. Sometimes you are blessed, sometimes you suffer, and you're not in control of that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So his integrity is consistent, or at least we see it here, maybe for the first time.
We didn't really see it.
We hadn't seen it in the previously. But this, though it says the Lord is with him and he finds favor and so on, this doesn't prevent him from being thrown into prison, from being sold into slavery. So, yeah. But it's the beginning of a kind of character development for him where these other people are foils. I would say the same thing is true of chapter 38. The brother Judah is set up as a kind of foil for Joseph in some ways. And incidentally, about... you know, when we talk that way, this episode moves into a place where he can demonstrate his virtue again and so on. This by no means suggests that that this didn't happen. It's a, the writer's making choices about what to include in the account. And so I just want to say that if some of us start talking that way, it's not as if we think it was all made up. But yeah, excuse me. Did you?
This is just a little point, but once again, he's not involved with anything in the field. Is it like when he was a boy, he was always involved with things in the house with his father, and once again, he's in charge of the house again.
So he may have been prepared in some ways for this kind of work in his childhood.
We felt that it's difficult to evaluate this objectively because we know too much. We know the end.
Yeah.
Whatever this guy on the radio said, the other half of the story or whatever, you know. We know the ending. But if you take what went before and this, both as being put in a pit by his brothers and sold, and then this, our miseries in his life, which were character forming and were a real test that made him grow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not only character forming, but we always struggle with the dilemma, why do terrible things happen to good people? And so to me, that's always one of my struggles. And here is this good guy who is in terrible trouble, and it may be that these terrible things were part of God's plan. Because we talked about maybe being put in jail needed to be necessary for Pharaoh to notice him. Because Pharaoh might not have been aware of this wonderful person in Potiphar's household. But when he's in the king's, and made a point of saying this, is the king's prisoners.
Right.
So when he starts doing wonderful stuff there, then the Pharaoh will know it, and then the next step can happen. So maybe sometimes these bad things all fit into God's plan.
That's certainly going to be Joseph's interpretation later on, too. We all know that's coming. You mentioned something that's kind of interesting, corrective to Linda's concern about the Lord being with him and everything prospering. That's stated right here several times, but right in the midst of these statements, he's in slavery, he's exiled from his people, he's cut off from his family, and now he's in prison for 13 years. So it's the prosperity is tempered at least by some other things here. Nevertheless, the assumption, the assumption is here. Okay. What other observations about that episode that we haven't mentioned?
I think you also mentioned it in connection to the story, but it's still true today that those persons who are objects of sexual abuse, the victims of sexual abuse, male or female, are often helpless. He couldn't get himself away from her. He had to serve in the house. And they are, the victims are often the ones who are made the guilty and are not believed. And just reading this story is a reminder of the pain of the victims over the centuries. And our hope is that the Lord is with them as well and will help them to survive.
Yeah.
I was wondering whether maybe this is intended to help establish the character of Joseph, if that is significant at all, that he was a good person with integrity.
Yes, yes, indeed. That's certainly one of the main functions of this. And as some people have said, certain parts of his character, his integrity, his as you know, thinking about God as his guide, and kind of righteousness over against the, wasn't the word you used, the as over against the sin of this woman, establishes his character, something of his character anyway. Was there anything else?
I was wondering, when this change of character happened here, yesterday we had talked about him being telling on his brothers and being really a snip and very likable, and all of a sudden we have a complete change in character here when it all just happened.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, it was just suggested that this kind of suffering creates character. And whether it's fair to attribute it to that is also some aging here. It's a critical growing years for a young man. you might assume there could be some change that takes place because of those two things, but maybe you could say, what's the difference? The big difference here in the text is the Lord was with him.
I wonder if he acted inside that premise within, he was in a prayer. I don't think it says, but I just wonder how he got through all this stuff. He wasn't in a prayer. He was one to whom God revealed
dreams and the meaning of dreams. One senses from those accounts that he has some kind of connection to God, and at least in his own mind, we haven't seen him say it yet here. He's going to say it in a minute, that God is working to help him interpret the dreams and so on. So at least it doesn't say he prays, doesn't say he spends time. He's got these years in prison, and he'd have some time to do it.
Isn't it a case of where God appears to have picked out someone, as he did so many times in the Old Testament and the New Testament, and made something of them?
Yeah.
Or,
And he just comes as a gift. Doesn't say he does anything to get it.
Right.
But he was the select one, as with Abraham and with Jacob.
Yeah. Well, let's look on ahead here just to reiterate at the end of this chapter, starting at verse 21. Now he's in jail, not just in exile, but in jail. And the Lord was with Joseph, showed him steadfast love, gave him favor in the sight of the jailer, as he did with Potiphar. And so the jailer commits to Joseph's care everything. And the chief jailer paid no heed to anything that was in Joseph's care. Same theme. Doesn't have to worry about anything, because Joseph is there. And the repetition at the very end of the chapter, because the Lord was with him, and whatever he did, the Lord made it prosper. Same linkage is there again. Somebody pointed out, you know, the end of chapter 37, he was down in the depths, and now at the end of chapter 39, he's stuck in prison. There does seem to be that movement, although there's a completely different feeling here because the Lord is with him. And we know that that's significant. Now, I'm going to just summarize what happens in chapter 40, and then we'll read the second half of 41. In chapter 40, in prison, the baker and the cupbearer, the chief cupbearer of the Pharaoh, are in prison too. They have dreams. Joseph interprets the dreams. The dreams are prophetic. The things are borne out the way Joseph interprets them. And Joseph says to the cupbearer, "But remember me when it's well with you. Please do me the kindness to make mention of me to Pharaoh." All right. At the end of the chapter, these things are borne out. Verse 23, "Yet the chief cupbearer did not remember Joseph, but forgot him." In this segment, remembering and forgetting are come around a number of times and are part of the theme, I think. Well then, after two whole years, so he's two more years in prison, Pharaoh has this dream, the famous dream of the fat, didn't we used to call him kine? That just came into my mind. Was that what they were called in the King James Version or something? The
maybe.
Fat kine and the lean kine? Anyway, and the ears of corn. Pharaoh, here then the chief cupbearer says, "Now I remember my faults. There was this guy who could interpret dreams." Pharaoh calls him immediately. And interestingly, a little note is added here in verse 14. Pharaoh sent for Joseph. When he had shaved himself and changed his clothes. I mention that because the clothing of Joseph seems to be figuring in this story. There's the long robe first with sleeves, then there's the robe that Potiphar's wife rips off of him, and in both cases the clothing is used to deceive people about Joseph. Now he makes a point. You know, why do we need to know he shaved himself? But he changed his clothes and came in, and Pharaoh says, "You can interpret dreams." And Joseph answered Pharaoh, "It is not I. God will give Pharaoh a favorable answer," which incidentally is just what he said to the chief cupbearer. who said, no one can interpret our dreams, Joseph said, this is verse 8 in chapter 40, do not interpretations belong to God? Please tell them to me. It's an interesting combination that raises the question, how does God work? If God is doing things, how does God do them? Do not interpretations come from God? Tell them to me. For me, one of the interesting questions about this section of the story is, how much of what happens to Joseph and through Joseph do we attribute to God? And how much do we attribute to Joseph's ingenuity or his own resources? And I just leave that question with you. At any rate, Joseph says to the Pharaoh, it is not I, God will give Pharaoh an answer. Here's the answer, starting at verse 25. Let's have our readers finish off the chapter.
Then Joseph said to Pharaoh,
the dream of Pharaoh is one. God has revealed to Pharaoh what he is about to do. The seven good cows are 7 years, and the seven good years are 7 years. The dream is one. The seven lean and the gaunt cows that came up after them are 7 years, and the seven empty ears blighted by the east wind are also 7 years of famine. It is I who told Pharaoh, God has shown to Pharaoh what he is about to do. There will come 7 years of great plenty throughout all the land of Egypt. But after them there will arise 7 years of famine, and all the plenty will be forgotten in the land of Egypt. The famine will consume the land, and the plenty will be unknown in the land by reason of that famine which will follow, for it will be very grievous. And the doubling of Pharaoh's dream means that the thing is fixed by God, and God will shortly bring it to pass. Now therefore, let Pharaoh select a man discreet and wise and set him over the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh proceed to appoint overseers of the land and take the fifth part of the produce of the land of Egypt during the seven plenteous years. And let them gather all the food of these good years that are coming, and lay up grain under the authority of Pharaoh for food in the cities, and let them keep it. That food will be a reserve for the land against the 7 years of famine which are to befall the land of Egypt, so that the land may not perish through this famine.
This proposal seemed good to Pharaoh and to all his servants. Then Pharaoh said to his servants,
can we find such a man as this, in whom is the Spirit of God?
So Pharaoh said to Joseph,
since God has shown you all this, there is none so discreet and wise as you are. You shall be over my house, and all my people shall order themselves as you command. Only as regards the throne will I be greater than you.
And Pharaoh said to Joseph,
behold, I have set you over the land of Egypt.
Then Pharaoh took his signet ring from his hand and put it on Joseph's hand, and arrayed him in garments of fine linen, and put a gold chain about his neck. And he made him to ride in his second chariot, and they cried before him, bow the knee. Thus he set him over all the land of Egypt. Moreover, Pharaoh said to Joseph,
I am Pharaoh, and without your consent no man shall lift up hand or foot in all the land of Egypt.
And Pharaoh called Joseph's name, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On. So Joseph went out over the land of Egypt. Joseph was 30 years old when he entered the service of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And Joseph went out from the presence of Pharaoh and went through all the land of Egypt. During the seven plenteous years, the earth brought forth abundantly, and he gathered up all the food of the 7 years, and when there was plenty in the land of Egypt, and stored up the food of the cities. He stored up in every city the food from the fields around it. And Joseph stored up grain in great abundance, like the sand of the sea, until he ceased to measure it, for it could not be measured. Before the year of famine came, Joseph had two sons, whom Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, bore to him. Joseph called the name of the firstborn Manasseh, for he said,
God has made me forget all my hardship in all my father's house.
The name of the second he called Ephraim,
for God has made me fruitful in the land of my affliction.
The 7 years of plenty that prevailed in the land of Egypt came to an end, and the 7 years of famine began to come, as Joseph had said. There was famine in all land, but in all the lands of Egypt there was bread. When all the land of Egypt was famished, the people cried to Pharaoh for bread. And Pharaoh said to all the Egyptians,
go go to Joseph. What he says to do, do.
So when the famine had spread over all the land, Joseph opened all the storehouses and sold to the Egyptians, for the famine was severe in the land of Egypt. Moreover, all the earth came to Egypt to Joseph to buy grain, because the famine was severe over all the earth.
Okay, that's the section that we'll end with for today. I don't suppose we need to say anything about the interpretation of the dream just now. I want to point out the analogy to what's happened to Joseph twice earlier in the earlier chapter. As soon as he interprets this dream in this way, Pharaoh says, I'm putting you in charge of everything. Thus he set him over all the land of Egypt. It's the same. Yeah, that's right. If only we could run interviews like this. He knows how to make a good first impression.
But also, there's this additional thing. Since God has shown you all this, there's no one as discreet and wise as you.
Yeah. So Pharaoh recognizes the Spirit of God in him. In whom is the Spirit of God?
Same with the priest, jail keeper.
That keeps coming up as the feature of Joseph in this section of the story, that people notice. God is with him, God favors him, the Spirit of God is in him, and as a result, they give him great authority. It doesn't seem to always work that way in our culture.
But, it doesn't work that way everywhere in the Bible. The Bible is interesting in that you have these whole themes where clearly people get it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get whole other, in the New Testament, you get whole other Gospels where,
right.
For example, but even people in the Old Testament, when the prophets come along and everybody sort of misses the
right.
Point.
In fact, this is much more an exception. I would say that's more the normal pattern, isn't it? That the people of God are mistreated and distrusted. But here, because God is with him, he's entrusted with great authority, even in a foreign land. Notice the two names that Joseph gives his children. Manasseh, which means making to forget, for God has made me forget all my hardship and my father's house. Remember how the story begins with that terrible family dynamic problem. And not only has he forgotten the hardship, but he's forgotten his family. So he says. And the attribution to God. The name is chosen because God has made me forget. And again, then that second name, for God has made me fruitful. The things that have happened in Egypt are attributed to God again.
When African Christians choose names for baptism, many of them choose Joseph, Ephraim, and Manasseh, their favorite name.
Finally, at the end of this section, after the famine has spread over the world, all the world comes to Joseph and to Egypt, and right away reminds us of one of Joseph's dreams when the stars, the sun, and the moon were bowing down before him. Even before the brothers show up, we get this sense that this dream is being fulfilled. And that through this process and through this man, God is blessing all the world. The world is being saved from starvation by this presence of God with this man in this story. Well, I would like you now, as you think about this, to group yourselves again. Pick the same group, different group if you want. Do we have time to do this? I think so. And let me just ask the people on this half of the room, break right there, you people on this half of the room, talk about the issue of forgetting and remembering. And it comes up a number of times in here. And how is God connected to the theme of forgetting and remembering in this section of the story? And just see what you come up with on that, okay? And then you on this half of the room, I would like you to discuss to what extent do you as a reader or the reader or hearer of this story attribute what happens to Joseph to God, and to what extent to Joseph's own ingenuity? Or maybe that's the wrong way of putting it. If you find another way you want to put it, how is God working in Joseph? Is it strictly a gift, a direct inspiration? Is it somehow based on his own ingenuity and creativity with those gifts? I think that we get some of each in here, and I'd like you to look at that. Joseph attributes everything to God. When you hear the story, do you attribute it all to God, or do you think of him as a shrewd character too?